And with our special guest tonight, Graham Hancock. We'll be back with Graham in a moment. Lots more to talk about right here on Coast to Coast AM. Graham Hancock, our guest right here on Coast to Coast. Graham, tell us about the work of Dr. Rick Strassman. You were mentioning him a little bit. And when did he do this kind of work?
Absolutely. Can I just give another heads up to your listeners about the visit I'm making to the U.S. during November?
Absolutely.
I'm going to be giving two public lectures. One of them we mentioned earlier is at Sedona on 12th of November for the CPAC conference. I'll be talking there. And the other one is in New York City on the 17th of November. I'll be lecturing on my new book, Supernatural, and showing slides to support the lecture at the Chapel of the Sacred Mirrors in New York City on the 17th of November. And again, details of all of this are on my website, www.grahamhancock.com, on the Supernatural page. Anybody who's interested in attending either of those lectures will find full details there. And just the last heads up that I'd like to mention, my new book, Supernatural, is not yet published in the U.S., but it will be next year in the bookshops and is available right now immediately from Amazon.com and Amazon.ca in Canada. Just search Graham Hancock Supernatural.
Aren't websites fantastic?
I think websites are wonderful. I think they've brought the world together.
I
get people sending me messages from China and Fiji and the United States and Germany and all over the world. I feel it's made me part of a huge community, and I really love it. I think it's a wonderful, wonderful thing.
Two individuals I want to talk about this hour, of course, is the work of Rick Strassman, and also we'll talk about Francis Crick again as well. But tell me about Dr. Strassman.
Okay, well, Dr. Rick Strassman is a fascinating man, a brilliant scientist, and he's a psychiatrist at the University of New Mexico. And back in 2001, Rick published a very important book called DMT, The Spirit Molecule. And that extremely important book outlines the results of his fascinating research. This was the first research using hallucinogens and human volunteers that had been authorized by the federal government of the United States for more than 20 years. And Rick started this research in the 1990s and finished it in the late 1990s, using hundreds of volunteers and administering to them the powerful short-acting hallucinogen DMT, which is also the principal ingredient of the ayahuasca brew in the Amazon. Now, in the Amazon, because it's mixed with another plant, the effects last much longer. They last 2 to 3 hours. Whereas DMT given in pure form, as Rick Strassman did at the University of New Mexico with his volunteers, produces an extremely powerful out-of-body journey into another realm that lasts only about 20 minutes, and then full normal consciousness returns. Now, Rick's project was, first of all, to discover whether there was any therapeutic value to DMT. But, of course, in our society, we define the notion of therapeutic value very narrowly. As Rick started to administer this substance to his volunteers, he began to notice, as he compiled their reports over a period of years, that all of them, even though they didn't actually know each other very often and had no shared or common background, that all of them seemed to be reporting meeting the same beings in their altered state of consciousness.
Isn't that something? The same ones.
The same ones in the same extraordinary settings, and that these beings seem to want to communicate with them and communicate information to them. But even more intriguing, 80% of the volunteers reported experiences that were absolutely identical to the experiences that are reported by UFO abductees, by people who believe they've been abducted by aliens on board UFOs. And yet we know that the bodies of those volunteers were not abducted onto a UFO, because they were lying right there on a hospital bed under Rick Strassman's watchful eye in the University of New Mexico. But their consciousness, as they reported it, seemed to take on a body of its own, and that consciousness body then traveled into the other realm and met these extraordinary beings. And many of the same things that the beings are reported to do to alien abductees, such as putting implants into their bodies, doing strange experiments
right.
on them, interfering with their reproductive system, manipulating their DNA. These experiences were all reported by Rick Strassman's volunteers. Now, skeptics might say, ah, well, the obvious answer to this is that those volunteers had been reading the tabloid press,
mm-hmm.
and they simply regurgitated from their imagination the imagery that's already out there in the culture. But Rick Strassman has a complete answer to that, and that is that other experiments using DMT were done in the early 1950s with human volunteers in Europe. At that time, although there had been some UFO sightings, nobody in the world was reporting abductions by aliens. And yet, those human volunteers who were given DMT back in the 1950s did report exactly the same experiences that we now record as alien abductions, small beings with triangular heart-shaped faces and large dark eyes, abducting them up to some strange space in the sky and conducting painful experiments on them. So what becomes clear from Rick Strassman's work is that the reason this imagery is in our culture in the first place is because it has been derived from altered states of consciousness. Now, here's the intriguing thing that Rick has established. The pineal gland in the human brain mm-hmm. produces DMT, the powerful hallucinogen. We actually make it in our own body.
And I think as you get older, that production slows down.
Yes, it can. It can slow down. It's mm-hmm. particularly active in younger people. But what Rick suggested, to cut a long story short, is that that 2% of the population who spontaneously fall into trance and have the alien abduction experience mm-hmm. may do so because their brains have overproduced DMT and changed their consciousness, retuned the receiver wavelengths of their brain, and allowed them access to the other realm. It's very important to emphasize that Rick Strassman is not a reductionist. He doesn't reduce this to just brain chemistry. He believes that what is happening is that, or what may be happening, is that we need to understand the brain as a receiver, rather like a television receiver.
Mm-hmm.
And for most of us, that television receiver is tuned into channel normal all the time. And actually, we do need to be tuned into channel normal, at least most of the time,
right.
in order to function in the daily world. Otherwise, we would become dysfunctional. And one
mm-hmm.
can see why evolution has set the receiver wavelength of our brain on the particular channel appropriate to life on this planet. But that what happens when we take a substance like DMT, or when our own brains overproduce it, or when we use other shamanic techniques to enter altered states of consciousness, is that the receiver wavelength of the brain is altered, and we pick up, well, Rick calls it channel DMT, where real beings, utterly real reality that is not accessible to us in ordinary states of consciousness, suddenly does become accessible to us. So he was suggesting that these experiences are absolutely real, but that our very materialistic science cannot get to grips with it because it is only accessible in certain states of consciousness. And those states of consciousness may be mediated by DMT, and that it cannot be an accident that our evolution has given us this potential. Evolution gives us nothing unless it's useful. And it therefore suggests that these altered states of consciousness are incredibly useful to the human species. And indeed, to come back to the theme of my book, I do argue that the extraordinary before and after event that took place in human prehistory around 40,000 years ago, when a light was suddenly switched on in our heads all around the world, precisely had to do with our discovery of altered states of consciousness, which gave us access to these other realms and to the vital information that is available to us in those realms.
Did Strassman change gears when you said that he initially started to test for therapeutic use of DMT? Did
yes.
he ultimately change his entire study to undertake happened to the mind?
Yes, in a sense, that was forced upon him by the reports of the volunteers themselves. Within the rather narrow framework that the West defines therapeutic value, he could find no therapeutic value for DMT. But what he did find was that it opened it seemed to open a doorway inside our minds that lead us through into another dimension, and that these experiences are extraordinary and mysterious and desperately need to be researched. But precisely because he couldn't pin down in the narrow Western frame a specific therapeutic value from those experiences, he was in fact unable to continue with his research. And he wrapped up his research towards the end of the 1990s, and then published the results in his book DMT, the Spirit Molecule. And those results caused Rick Strassman to change his own view of reality. He is now absolutely convinced, as I am, that reality is much more complicated than we imagine, and that the very small part of reality that we normally relate to, like an iceberg, the tip of the iceberg is above the surface, but 9/10 of it is below the surface. 9/10 of reality may be below the surface of our normal everyday consciousness, but it may be vitally important for us to find ways to access that other 9/10 of reality below the surface, and that's what altered states of consciousness appears to allow us to do.
Graham, can we assume that through this altered state, where all these people witnessed the same thing,
yes,
that these beings that they found in either other dimensions via this portal, that they indeed do look like the Greys then that so many people have talked about, that they do physically have the long arms, the big heads, and
yeah,
they have the big black eyes?
That does seem to be the case. Let me tell you something astonishing. There are even paintings of those beings in the painted caves of Europe going back 35,000 years.
Oh, my.
Human beings have been encountering these other beings for at least 35,000 years, and we have a definite record of their presence in the painted caves of Upper Paleolithic Europe, and I report this in detail in my book Supernatural. It's documentary evidence for encounters with precisely the same sort of beings as our modern alien abductees report. And in fact, if you go and talk to shamans in tribal societies today, you will find that they are also reporting the same kinds of contacts with the same kind of beings. And this is a great mystery, and it really is almost perverse to deny that there is something real behind it when we find that it's an experience that not only affects us today, but that affected our ancestors 35,000 years ago, and that at that time was clearly and undeniably connected to a radical change in human behavior that made us the species we are today, that actually made us human.
If these alien abductees are traveling in their conscious mind, so their physical bodies, of course, remain, as we
yes,
were talking about, why then do we hear so many reports of these experiments that are being conducted on what they think might be their physical body?
And indeed, they sometimes find physical implants in their physical bodies.
True.
Yes.
True. Now, but if
I think
if,
the answer to that is that I want to call it the spirit world. I honestly don't believe that we are dealing with nuts and bolts aliens who come here in flying saucers from a distant part of this universe. I think we're dealing with transdimensional beings who approach us from different dimensions that evolution has given us the opportunity to relate to in altered states of consciousness.
Even though we may be years behind where they are.
Even though we may be millions of years
yes,
behind where they are, even though we may have nothing to teach them and they may have everything to
mm-hmm,
teach us,
mm-hmm,
that these experiences are available to us in altered states of consciousness. So the mysterious thing is that those beings from other realms or other dimensions, if that is what we're dealing with, and I believe that that's one very good answer to this mystery, they seem to have a particular project with us. It's almost as though they want to gain for themselves the physicality that we have. And this is why so many alien abductees report reproductive work being done on
right,
by the alien beings. And again, astonishingly, shamans in the Amazon and in South Africa and in Australia report exactly the same thing being done to them by spirits. In fact, they often report that they have a wife or a husband in the spirit world, and they've produced children in the spirit world, and that these children have this rather strange appearance with large heads and long limbs and exactly like we describe our aliens. And so it seems that there may be some kind of breakthrough from the other dimensions into our dimension, and that this breakthrough may be purposive, it may be intended, and we desperately need to know what's going on with it.
This is just fascinating work that you and Strassman and other people have done in this arena. If this is happening and these beings are trying to do whatever they're doing, is it possible that there's something evil behind it?
Yes, it is possible that there's something evil behind it.
Oh, my.
The spirit world is not all goodness. I do believe that there are forces of darkness and forces of evil at work in the universe, as well as forces of good. And that those, just as we may encounter manifestations of those forces in this physical world, we can also encounter it in the other world. And that's why it's very important to be armed and prepared and alert before undertaking consciousness journeys of this sort. And this is precisely why shamans in places like the Amazon really do have something to teach us, because they are not the passive victims of these experiences. They have these experiences at will, at their own will, at their own choice, and they access those experiences primarily by drinking the brew that we discussed earlier, ayahuasca. And then they send their consciousness into the spirit world, and instead of being the victims of the spirits, they become the masters of the spirits, and they work with the spirits, and they find those that are good, and they work with them against those that are bad. And part of the shaman's mission is to reduce the evil forces that fall on this planet from the supernatural realms.
Do you believe some of this could also be attributed to what people think might be angels?
Yes. I think that every supernatural experience that humans have ever reported, whether it be angels, whether it be demons, whether it be fairies, whether it be elves, whether it be ghosts, remember that the shamans constantly meet the spirits of deceased ancestors, that all of these experiences are accessible and only accessible in altered states of consciousness. And this is precisely why these experiences are so elusive in this physical world. Because we see the experiences through our own cultural filter, we may define them in different ways. For some people, they may say the being is an angel. For another person, he may say the being is a spirit. Another person may say the being is an alien. But at the end of the day, there's a being there who does not conform to the rules of our everyday reality. And beings that don't conform to the rules of our everyday reality are best described as supernatural beings.
I got to tell you, Graham, the work, is much needed. It is unfortunate that mainstream science really doesn't touch it too much.
Mainstream science, apart from great scientists like Dr. Rick Strassman, has turned its back on this area of inquiry. Without any good reason, without any serious work being done on the matter, our society has created a gigantic prejudice against altered states of consciousness. You know, we're very happy for people to blitz themselves into oblivion with alcohol every night. We're very happy for people to close down their mental processes by watching endless hours of the most awful television. But if a free and independent adult chooses to experiment with his own consciousness, to explore his own consciousness through sacred plants that grow naturally alongside us on this planet, if an individual does that, then he can be sent to prison in our society. We so value the alert, problem-solving state of consciousness needed to deal with the everyday world that we have simply neglected, cut off, ignored, dismissed the other 90% of our consciousness. And it was that 90% of our consciousness, I believe, that made us human.
We'll be back with Graham Hancock in a moment. We're going to continue this incredible story, this journey. By the way, Dr. Strassman was a guest on our program back about a year ago when he talked a little bit about this. Truly a remarkable man. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, on our next Coast to Coast program, Ed and Chris Sherwood will be our guests with some new crop circle research. A lot of this could tie into what we're talking about with Graham Hancock, something that might work through altered states, perhaps. Something's going on, I'll tell you that. We'll be back in a moment. Next hour, we'll open up the phone lines. You can talk with Mr. Hancock as well on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast with Graham Hancock, our guest. Graham, let's talk a bit, if we can, about Francis Crick. And you really sparked my interest when you talked about the ability to see the dead. So we'll get into that as well. Now Crick wins the Nobel Prize for his work of structure of DNA. Some have said that he himself might have been in an altered state.
Yes, this information astonishingly came out just 8 days after Crick's death. He had suppressed it during his life, and he threatened to sue any newspaper that published it, but he admitted that that the information was true. In the early 1950s, when Francis Crick discovered the double helix structure of DNA, he regularly consumed LSD. LSD at that time was completely legal, and Crick felt that it enhanced his mental and creative powers. He took low doses of LSD virtually every week, and he admitted that it was under the influence of LSD in a visionary state that he first saw the double helix form. And it is that vision that enabled him to crack the code of DNA. And it's on the basis of that vision that he won the Nobel Prize. And he, in fact, is one amongst many scientists who have received vital information of a scientific nature in altered states of consciousness. So that's the first remarkable thing about Crick, the Nobel Prize winner, the ultimate mainstream scientist, that Crick saw the structure of DNA, the double helix structure, under the influence of LSD. But there's more. Our scientists today are absolutely, most of them, are absolutely against the idea of any kind of intelligent design in the universe. They dismiss it utterly, right, as a new ploy of creationism. They laugh at it. They ridicule it. They just despise the idea. And yet the greatest scientist, one of the greatest scientists of the 20th century, Francis Crick himself, did not believe that the DNA molecule had evolved on this planet. And believe me, as a scientist, Francis Crick was far beyond those scientists who now dismiss intelligent design.
And let's mention that one more time, because that's probably one of the most critical things of Crick's entire career, I think. He did not believe that the DNA here came from this planet, or
that's
its origin was here. Okay.
That's right. He didn't. And he published a book, in 1981, called Life Itself, which outlines this theory. And he came to the theory entirely on scientific grounds. Looking at the DNA molecule with its fantastic double helix structure and its ability to code for the construction of cells and proteins, in fact, its ability to form beings of all kinds as we know them, that this interaction between the double helix molecule of DNA and the proteins, in his view, was far too complicated to have just emerged by accident out of some kind of hypothetical primeval soup on planet Earth. Believe it or not, that's what most scientists claim, and I think those scientists are giving us a fairy story. They claim that the DNA molecule somehow just developed accidentally from different chemicals bumping against each other on the early Earth. Crick, the greatest scientist in this field, absolutely denied that. He said there's no way at all that the DNA molecule could have formed by accident on this planet in the time that was available for it.
Now, does he go on, Graham, to talk about how he believes it got here? I mean,
yes.
Are we talking about panspermia coming
we
from
are
comets
talking
and
about,
stuff?
We're talking about panspermia, and we're particularly talking about Crick's version of panspermia, which is directed panspermia. Crick didn't subscribe to the view that the molecules of life are just carried randomly through the universe on comets and asteroids and bump into planets and start life. In his view, it happened this way. He envisaged an alien civilization on the other side of the galaxy. He pointed out that there's been 15 billion years since the Big Bang, and that there was time for life to have evolved on another planet before the Earth was even formed, and the Earth was formed about 4 billion years ago. And his suggestion was that life evolved on another distant planet, and eventually, after billions of years, it produced a highly intelligent creature. And that highly intelligent creature developed a technology that was far in excess of anything we have today. And they realized, and remember, this is Crick, Francis Crick, the Nobel Prize winner, saying this, not me. They realized that their culture was doomed, that perhaps there was going to be a supernova explosion in the vicinity, and that they would all be wiped out, and that there was no way that they could physically escape from it. And he suggests that what they did was they took the most resilient life forms on their planet, containing the DNA of their planet, bacteria, which can survive in any environment, that they packed them into huge spacecraft, they froze billions in cryogenic suspension, billions of bacteria in these spacecraft, and they sent them off in the universe in all directions, hoping that those spacecraft carrying bacteria would collide with a planet in a suitable state of development, and there would begin to reproduce very rapidly, and the whole story of evolution would begin again, so that life would be preserved, life would be saved. That was Crick's theory of directed panspermia, and that's how he explains that the DNA molecule suddenly appears on this planet, and from a situation in which there was no life, we suddenly have life reproducing and replicating all over the planet.
What if it came to this planet through these portals that people see when they're under the influence of ayahuasca?
Perfectly possible. Crick, of course, did not consider that. He went far enough by suggesting that the DNA molecule couldn't have come from Earth, that it had to have been sent from elsewhere. But I do go into that possibility in the book, that we may be dealing with a transdimensional attempt to seed life on Earth, and that having done that, those beings then maintain an interest in life on Earth, and they may have a very specific project for life on Earth that we don't know yet fully what it is, that they realized that the way to develop life is through the process of evolution. So they sent very simple organisms to this planet, but packed with the DNA of their planet.
Yes.
And that those organisms then began evolving, and they realized that eventually, it might take billions of years, but eventually an intelligent creature just like them would evolve on this planet, and that intelligent creature might have built into the DNA a method for that intelligent creature to access information that is on the DNA itself. This is the very extraordinary idea at the heart of this. You see, the mystery that I'm looking at in Supernatural is why people all around the world in altered states of consciousness see the same things and have the same experiences. One explanation for that, and I devote a great deal of space to it in the book, and I take it very seriously indeed, is that in these altered states of consciousness, we may be accessing real parallel dimensions and the beings who inhabit them. But another possibility, if Crick's theory is correct, is that those bacteria that started life on Earth 4 billion years ago contained DNA that had been genetically engineered. And that DNA may, it is quite possible, DNA carries vast quantities of information, which is used to construct bodies and beings, that DNA may contain other kinds of information. It may, in fact, contain the entire accumulated knowledge of that hypothetical other civilization at the other side of the galaxy that seeded life on our planet. There is a thing called junk DNA. It's 97% of our DNA. And we don't know anything about it.
That's true.
We think we know a lot about DNA, but all we know about is the 3% that is involved in genes. The other 97% of DNA, our scientists are largely ignorant about, and that's why they tend to call it junk DNA, as though 97% of our DNA would be preserved down millions of years of evolution if it was just junk. Of course it's not junk. Of course there's something important to it. And scientists at Boston University, Dr. Eugene Stanley was the leader of the team, discovered during the 1990s that junk DNA has astonishing properties. It has astonishing linguistic properties. I won't go into the full details here. I published them in my book. But junk DNA has the same structure as all human languages. And Eugene Stanley at Boston University concluded that there must be a message written on our DNA. And what I'm adding to that is the possibility that it may be that message or those messages, perhaps an enormous interactive teaching machine that has been recorded on our DNA, which we may also access in altered states of consciousness. And that's why we all see the same thing, because we all have the DNA, the same DNA, and that DNA is in every cell of our bodies, including in our brain cells. And perhaps a mechanism had been devised billions of years ago to enable us to access hard information on our own DNA, which can reveal to us the secrets of why we are really here. That is the other possibility that I take very seriously in my book and explore very seriously. I don't take a dogmatic position. I'm not saying definitely it's because there are parallel universes and real spirits, and I'm not saying definitely it's because there's an interactive message recorded on our DNA. But what I'm saying is that the evidence seems to suggest that it is one or the other of those extraordinary possibilities. Either we enter altered states of consciousness and open a secret doorway inside our own minds that leads us through to other dimensions that are real but not normally accessible to us, or it's a secret chamber inside our own minds, a hall of records, a chamber of archives that we are able to enter in altered states of consciousness, which contain vital information for our future evolution.
What if, as you read in the Bible, the wording of fallen angels all has to do with this entry through this portal as well? Is that possible?
I believe that it does. I think that it is this extraordinary ability we have to enter altered states of consciousness and have experiences that are not available to us in normal states that lies beyond a huge range of mysteries. It lies behind a huge range of mysteries in the human past. And it may be the case that particularly if the spirit world explanation of this is the correct explanation, that beings are actually coming through that portal into this realm and contacting us at a physical level as well as at the level of consciousness. And that perhaps would be where the idea of fallen angels come from, and why, if we read in Genesis 6:6, why these sons of God, as they were called, wanted to mate with the daughters of men and wanted to produce offspring from the daughters of men.
Exactly. Change the DNA, right?
Change the DNA. Exactly as UFO abductees report that aliens want to do to us today, that they want to, somehow, for some reason, they want to breed with us. They want to acquire our physicality.
Tell me a little bit about this plant that enables people to see the dead. I mean, this fascinates me.
Well, as part of my research, I went and worked with shamans and consumed several of the shamanic plant hallucinogens that they use. One of these plant hallucinogens comes from Central Africa, and it's called ibogaine. It's from the root bark of the iboga plant, which grows in the rainforests of Central Africa. And ibogaine is called the plant that enables men to see the dead. And the tradition is that a pygmy was climbing a tree, and that one of the high gods knocked him down from the tree and killed him, then cut off his fingers and toes and planted them in various parts of the forest. When his wife was looking for this lost pygmy, a voice told her to eat of a certain bush, and she would see her husband again. That was the bush that had grown from his parts that had been buried in the forest. And when she ate of the bush, she met her husband. And this is now the center of a religious system in Central Africa. It's called the Bwiti religion, where tens of thousands of people consume ibogaine in order specifically to contact and meet their own ancestors and to learn vital information from them, to enter the spirit realm into which they believe our souls journey after death, and to gain regular access to that spirit realm. And I myself have consumed ibogaine. It is a very powerful, a very terrifying experience. It's physically very demanding. I was desperately ill for 48 hours during this experience.
And that's still under the tutelage of a shaman.
In that case, it was under the tutelage of a healer working here in Britain. Although ibogaine is totally illegal in the United States, By some miracle, it remains legal in Britain. And just as I mentioned that ayahuasca has been used successfully to get drug addicts off hard drugs like heroin and cocaine, so also ibogaine has been used to the same effect here in Britain. And we have a number of healers who are administering it to drug addicts. Now, I'm not a drug addict, and I've never touched heroin or cocaine in my life, and I never intend to do so. But fortunately, some of these healers are also prepared to administer ibogaine for the purposes of consciousness exploration. And it was under that idea that I took ibogaine. And I also had a medical doctor present with me while I took it, because there have been deaths from the consumption of ibogaine. Ibogaine, if you have a weak liver or a weak heart, ibogaine can kill you. And for that reason, I had a doctor present with me throughout the entire 48-hour session.
Were you scared?
I was very scared. I was very scared by what it did to me physically. I felt like my body had been broken and torn apart.
Would you ever take it again?
I would, but I would do so with some fear and caution. The experience itself was so interesting and so instructive. I learned a great deal about myself. I did encounter ghosts. I had the sense of a crowd of ghosts standing around the couch on which I was lying during this experience, and one amongst them seemed to be the ghost of my father, who had recently died and who I miss terribly and desperately. He didn't actually come to communicate with me in that vision, but I sensed his presence there, and I sensed that some important transaction had passed between us, which made it better somehow, made the fact of his loss, made it easier for me to deal with the fact of his loss.
Are they aware, Graham, that you have entered that altered state as much as you're aware of their presence? Are they aware of yours?
Absolutely. This is universally reported, not only in my own experience, but by many others who have taken these shamanic plants, that the beings and the ancestors and the ghosts and spirits that we encounter in that other realm are indeed aware of us. They can see us all the time, but in normal consciousness, we can't see them. We have to find the ways to put our consciousness onto the plane that they are on, and then we become aware of them as well, but they're already there. They're already waiting for us. The same thing was reported by Rick Strassman's volunteers on DMT, that the beings they encountered knew they were coming, welcomed the fact that they had discovered this technology, as one of the beings described it, that they'd discovered this technology which would enable them to communicate more and more freely in the future. And when the DMT trip came to an end and the person's consciousness went back into this world, those beings pretty much said, bye-bye, see you again soon.
I'll be talking with Ed and Chris Sherwood tomorrow about crop circles. People don't understand how they are created. This could be another way. This could be a way of communication through this altered state portal.
Yes, I think that crop circles are intimately connected to this problem. It's not an accident, by the way, that the supernatural beings that everybody in Europe related to back in the Middle Ages, the so-called fairies and elves, danced in circles, often in the grass, and left circular marks in the grass after the fairy dance had, been seen.
Leprechauns as well.
Leprechauns as well. Yes, they're all part of this. They're all part of this other world. And it may be the case that these crop circles themselves mark the position of portals on this earth through which we can pass into the other world. This idea has not yet been properly explored. One thing I am certain of is that crop circles are a gigantic and extraordinary mystery.
Stay with us, Graham. We're going to open up the phone lines now. We'll give you an opportunity to talk with legendary Graham Hancock right here on Coast to Coast AM.